Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Matt Parker. He is out with it's not a new book because it was a number one international bestseller over across the pond. It's Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Matt's written books. He used to teach, was a math teacher in school. He does stand-up comedy now. He does some YouTube channels, gives talks about all the fun things about math. And Matt, as I looked at this, I thought back to my high school days of taking math classes, and it was all I could do to really get through it, because whenever you're forced to do anything, it really is a disincentive. But taking it from your perspective, you make math fun, and so how does that translate into people learning from what you talk about?
That is a great point, Brian, because most people's experience with math was being forced to do it as a teenager, which is never a good way to enjoy anything. So a lot of people I meet are like, I hated math at school. So part of my motivation in the book was, as you say, was to kind of tell interesting stories of when there's been a math mistake, and things like, you know, bridges falling over or planes not crashing, but the computers crashing midair. These sorts of stories grab people's attention. How that then translates to learning is interesting. My kind of goal is more just math PR. I think if more people are more enthusiastic about mathematics and they think, you know what, it's something I can enjoy without necessarily being perfect at it, because you always make mistakes when you're learning math, then just having that slight cultural change of being accepting that it's difficult and not just dismissing it outright, I think that will help it. It'll be easier for young people to learn it.
You have countless examples in the book of how math has gone wrong in real-world situations by the top mathematicians and the top engineers in the world, and it's made for some disastrous results. The thing that I never understood until I read this book is that, you know, math, there's not always, well, there's usually a right answer, but sometimes takes a lot of trying just to get to that right answer. So how much of the process is part of just learning and doing mathematics?
Oh, goodness. This is the problem about people's perception of math, is it's all about getting the right answer. And as you say, most of the time, you're not just getting the right answer. You're making a lot of mistakes along the way. So the human brain, like, we are not naturally good at math, which is why everyone struggles with it. And as you're learning it, you're teaching your brain new ways to think. And the way your brain learns is by making mistakes. Like when you learn to walk as a kid, you fall over all the time. When you learn to talk, it takes forever. And likewise, when you're an adult learning math, you're going to make mistake after mistake as your brain's gradually getting better and better at it. But the point you make about engineering and all the top mathematicians is we still make mistakes all the time, and particularly something as complex as engineering, you'll think that we understand all the math, and then one day a bridge or a building will do something unexpected, and we realize that we've overlooked one key component.
I never thought about it until I really read your book, is that how much movement there is in different structures that's built into how they're designed. I mean, I would think you build a bridge, you just, you know, you put up the whatever the heck holds it up, and then it just stays put. That's not always the case. There's a lot to take in. So can you kind of explain how these mathematical equations go into the sway that a building is going to have or a bridge will have?
Yeah, because every structure will have some movement, some play in it. And that's important, because if it was perfectly rigid, then it would break easier, I guess. So you need to analyze the mathematics of the different frequencies, so the rate at which things can move, and we would say the resonant frequency. That's like the frequencies that really resonate with the building, and they're more likely to move at that frequency. So there was a tower built in South Korea in around 2011. This is one of my favorite examples of this, because one day people up on the 39th floor suddenly evacuated because the whole building started shaking, and they thought there was an earthquake. So they go racing out of the building, they get outside, and there's no earthquake. Everyone's like, what are you doing? And they're like, huh, that's odd. The whole building was shaking. And it turns out there was an exercise class on the 12th floor, and on that day they happened to exercise two snaps, I've Got the Power, which I won't attempt to sing here. It's about having the power. And the frequency of that song matched one of the frequencies at which the building would vibrate. And because they hit this resonant frequency, it's like if you hit exactly the right note on a guitar string, the whole thing will start vibrating, but other notes it won't happen. This song matched that frequency of the building, and the whole top of it started to sway. And you'll see this all the time in, like I said, bridges, buildings, any kind of structure. If we don't do the calculations very, very carefully to analyze all the frequencies, then you get these unexpected vibrations. And, I mean, in this case, no one died, but they can be quite dangerous.
Well, and of course, the song being Snaps, I Got the Power. And when you have a song like that so associated with it, that's got to be something that it's just become sort of a joke in the mathematic field about the I've Got the Power story, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you'd think it's like a one-off, but a friend of mine, that he analyzed stadiums in the UK, which you use for soccer, because whenever they put a music concert in there, people will dance to the different type of music, and that puts the stadium under different frequencies depending on what type of music is playing. And so there's this whole people who they research, people dancing at different rhythms and what kind of music you could or could not have in a stadium so that it will or won't, like, so stop it from vibrating dangerously.
I'm talking with Matt Parker about his book, Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold over here in the U.S. It was a number one bestseller in the U.K. Something I noticed, by the way, Matt, maybe you don't know the answer to this. In the U.K., there was an airplane on the front cover of the book, and when it's released in the United States, there's a looks like a bicycle or a tricycle. Any idea why?
Yeah, for some reason, they like to change the cover when it goes from the UK to the US. So the UK edition had a plane with the wings on backwards, and it had the word maths in it, with a like plural, with an S. So the US edition has a bike with square wheels, which is very funny, but they thought that was more visually catching for a US market, and they took out a lot of the S's. It's got way fewer S's and a lot more Z's. But in both cases, what I like is a plane with the wings on backwards. You can get some planes that have that arrangement. It makes them a lot more nimble and easier, well, quicker to control in the air, but harder to fly. And you can get bikes with square wheels. It just, you need a very specific surface that they roll over. So in both cases, I was pleased. It looks like a math mistake, but in very specific circumstances, it can still work.
I have to ask you about a book that came up within your book, The Fly and the Algorithm. It was the section, and it's the book, The Making of a Fly, an academic book. $23,000?
It hit $23 million.
$23 million, I'm sorry.
That's insane. Like, it may as well have been 23,000, but what happened was this was an academic book looking at kind of, you know, the genes of a fruit fly. And it should sell for, like, I don't know, it's a textbook. Like, $100 would, you know, I know textbooks are expensive. All right, these poor researchers in Berkeley went online one day to buy a copy on Amazon and saw that it was listed for millions of dollars. And what had happened is two different people who were selling the book had set the price algorithmically, which means they had, like, a rule, a calculation for how their price is generated, and it would change based on other prices. So one of them decided they wanted their price to be 27% more expensive than the second most expensive book, and someone else wanted their book to be slightly cheaper than the most expensive book. But the problem is, if one of them increased their price, the other one would then increase their price to match, and then the first one would increase their price, and then the second one would. And there's this feedback loop where each time one of them increased, the other one would increase, which would cause the first one to increase. And whoever programmed these pricing algorithms didn't put in a fail-safe. There was no stop if this gets ridiculous. And so the price just went up. It just ratcheted up and up and up and up and up. And at just over $23 million, it peaked at $23,698,655 plus $3.99 postage and handling. And then someone realized, and they reset it. So I actually bought a copy. And I was like, hey, this is the most expensive retail book ever. Or at least it was genuinely advertised at that price. But I spent $13.68 on a secondhand copy, which is a substantial discount.
And it's a bargain as well. When you talk about these math issues in the real world, and it's not just limited to structures and stuff we saw here with pricing, but also market crashes. You analyzed the different market crashes in 29 and going forward in the United States, the New York Stock Exchange. Can you explain how math algorithms sort may have related to some of that?
Well, it's a bit like what was happening on Amazon here. Here we've got two different sellers who have an algorithm, and the way they interact is the problem. So each one separately was fine. But if you combine both of them together, then you end up with this, I mean, we would say unexpected behavior, but it's the natural outcome of that. And so there was a problem in 2010 on May 6th when there was a flash crash, and the price just suddenly lost. It just plummeted by 9%. This was like the Dow Jones measure of the New York Stock Exchange, just suddenly, boom, 9% down. And then almost immediately, jump back up again. And everyone's like, what happened? And, I mean, we've had loads of other cases where there have been crashes or bizarre movements in the stock market, but this one in 2010 is just the most perfect example of all these different companies had set different pricing algorithms, so different rules for when they would buy or sell various financial stocks and products, and they believe that someone had basically dumped a certain type of financial product, I think called an E-mini, on the market at once, and it had this unexpected interplay of all these different algorithms, and it caused it to veer off one way and then come flying back the other. And so on one hand, these pricing algorithms are doing what the market normally does in terms of stabilizing prices and maximizing efficiencies, but on a much faster scale. But we've got to be careful, because when we're automating things, putting in these algorithms, it can go wrong. And the important thing is to make sure that we program in fail-safes and we keep a human in the loop. So if it passes certain thresholds, there's a human who can check it and see what's going on. Because if we totally hand it over to the algorithms, there are these unexpected little feedback loops which can sometimes crop up.
And, you know, you kind of mentioned this as well, and I found the financial stuff incredibly interesting here. The collateralized debt obligation in the subprime mortgage crisis back in the late 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s, and I know it's a little too complicated to understand from a mathematical standpoint, but sometimes there just aren't answers that you can simply point to, but you know something went wrong, right?
Well, exactly. And the subprime market, there were so many different factors going on at the same time that any one nice explanation, by definition of being nice, has obviously missed some important aspect. But the one bit I found interesting, and I didn't know enough about this to write about it with authority, was when people were packaging together, banks were getting these various mortgages and combining them, because their argument was, sure, some of these are going to go wrong, but if you package enough of them together, you can hedge that. You can hedge your bet, right? On average, they'll be fine. But then some of those still might go wrong, and so you repackage and repackage and repackage. And what it means is, when you're analyzing the probabilities, you've got to be very careful how you're kind of multiplying up the probability each time you're repackaging to try and average these things out. And if your assumption, if your starting probability is above a certain threshold, it gets better each time you repackage. If it's below a threshold, it'll actually get worse each time you repackage. And if assumptions were wrong to start with, then you can, as soon as one thing fails, it's just this huge, everything collapses. And I'm not saying, you know, that's the explanation of what happened, but there was a lot of complicated math and things all interplaying off each other, as well as obviously humans, which led to the problem.
All right, the book is Humble Pie, and that's P-I, by the way, as in 3.14, that number that we all know from, well, that's about as far as I know on it. When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World by Matt Parker. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. Check it out. The thing sold like gangbusters in the UK, and the algorithm says that it should sell like gangbusters in the US, right?
Yeah, let's hope so.
All right, Matt, thanks for joining us to talk about your book.
Thanks, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.